this morning and that I have to leave for parts of the council meetings. So I'm probably going to just keep talking through the normal break time until I get called out and have to go in there. Going to start, we left off yesterday with the crucifixion, circumstances of the crucifixion, went through prophecy about that from Psalm 22. You should have all received a copy of the booklet, Jesus Christ, the Real Story. I want to draw your attention to pages 34 and 35 in there. I'll start off with that today, and you'll find a lot of this information here in this sidebar, this colored box here on pages 34, 35 of the booklet. But I did want to talk about this a little bit and reinforce this, our belief about this in your minds, as well as some scholarship as well. As we all know, the most common symbol of Christianity today is the cross. But is this what Jesus Christ was crucified on? Can pretty much guarantee you that the traditional picture of Jesus Christ being crucified on a huge, tall cross like this is going to be wrong for a number of reasons. One is that, I've mentioned this before, there aren't a lot of tall, straight trees that grow in that part of the land, the Holy Land there. About the only ones that are tall and straight are palm trees, and you don't cut those down for something like this. Those are fruit trees, date palms, and so on. So you're limited by the type of timber, the wood that would be available for something like this. I kind of jokingly refer to this as Jesus being crucified on a telephone pole because it's just kind of ridiculous. They just did not have wooden trees like that in that area. And if there were any trees that tall and that straight, they would have been cut down and used for building timber, for roof rafters and things like that, long, long before. Also, I should mention, the Romans used different shapes of wood to crucify people. The word that is translated cross in the New Testament is the Greek word staros, staros here. And you'll find this mentioned in this sidebar here. But I would like to quote this here, and it denotes primarily an upright pail or stake. Pail is not a word used these days in English, but it basically means, yeah, an upright post would be what we would call it. Both the noun and the verb form, stero, I believe it's pronounced, to fasten to a stake or pail are originally to be distinguished from the ecclesiastical form of a two-beamed cross. That's a long way of saying this is not a traditional cross shape as we are all used to seeing. So this is from Vine's Expository Dictionary of Old and New Testament Words from 1995. The Bible does not contain any specific description of what Jesus was crucified on. It's not important enough for it to have been recorded for us, just like the day of Jesus Christ's birthday is not recorded. There are details that if the Gospels writers thought were important, they would have recorded them for us. But like the date of Christ's birth, this is not recorded, so it's not something that is all that important for us to know. However, having said that, there are some indications, which I will get into. We do know, and this illustration is in the booklet here, we do know that there were several forms of wooden structures that people were crucified on in this period, 1st century B.C., 1st, 2nd, 3rd century A.D. We know this from Roman writings. They describe some of them. Some of them were just a straight upright stake, as we have traditionally understood it. Some are shaped like a capital T. Some like the traditional lowercase T. There are a number of cases where people were crucified on trees, on a tree trunk, with a lot of the branches cut off, trimmed away. I should mention when the Gospels talk about taking up your cross. We discussed this briefly earlier. This was referring to the victims taking this cross piece, like this. It's not them taking the whole 10, 12 foot long crosses as you see depicted in so many movies. No, they were talking about taking the cross piece, which would then be attached to an upright post or stake in the ground. I should mention also the upright pole. Let me back up just a little bit. The Romans were masters of efficiency. I mean, they didn't build an empire, the biggest empire the world had ever seen, by being inefficient and incompetent. They were master engineers, built structures, temples, bridges, aqueducts that still stand today 2,000 years ago. They were very efficient. That was at the heart and core of Roman thinking. And also the Holy Land, I kind of touched on this a little bit too. It's basically solid rock, particularly around Jerusalem. It's built on a mountain ridge. So it's rock, it's limestone. And to think that the Romans would go to the effort of taking a pole or stake big enough to support a human body and digging a hole in rock and putting that post up and taking it down for every crucifixion is just nonsense. That's nonsensical. The Romans just did not think that way. They would take something that could be reused again and again and again, which might be a permanent pole, stake that is set in the ground, or might be a tree that they've just trimmed off the branches and used that tree trunk there. So these are some of the possibilities. The point I'm trying to make is that the traditional view of this giant cross is just wrong on so many levels there. So why might they use a tree trunk? Well, it's already there. It's already big enough to support a human body. So why go to the trouble of digging a hole, chipping a hole into solid rock to put a pole up if you've got a tree trunk there that you can use? So that is far less work and far more practical. And again, the Romans are all about efficiency. Let me show you a quote here from Seneca the Younger, a Roman historian. And he makes a point here. He's describing crosses. I see crosses there, staros again, not just of one kind, but made in many different ways. Some have their victims with head down to the ground. They're upside down, in other words. Some impale their private parts. I mentioned earlier this practice came from the Persians. Actually, forms of it go back to the Assyrians, the same Assyrians who invaded and took away the northern 10 tribes, where they did impale victims on a pole, but they ran the pole up through the person's body cavity and left the body hanging there that way. Persians picked that up, the Greeks and the Romans. Others stretch out their arms on the cross piece there, in the T-shape that it's describing there. So many different ways. The historian Josephus, I've talked quite a bit about the Roman surrounding Jerusalem in 70 AD and taking the city. And Josephus said they crucified people upside down, crucified them sideways, crucified them on X-shaped crosses. So yeah, Josephus talks about them in Jerusalem in 70 AD crucifying people all kinds of different ways. So we do know there was not a standard form, standard shape of a cross. My own personal view, and that of a number of scholars, it is clear that Jesus is carrying something to be crucified because, if you remember the story, the Romans call on a bystander and force him to take the cross because Jesus is too physically weak from the suffering he has endured to carry it. So he is carrying something. What's he carrying? He's probably carrying the cross piece to a stake or tree that is already in place. And that the cross piece is going to be much smaller than a stake or pole, which will need to be strong enough to support the entire weight of a human body. So this cross piece would then be attached to an upright stake, either by being nailed to it, more likely by being tied with ropes to it, because iron is still fairly valuable commodity at that time, fairly rare. My own view, and that of a number of scholars, is that Jesus is crucified on a literal tree, that the Romans took the two criminals who were crucified with him, to a spot alongside one of the main roads in and out of Jerusalem, nailed them to the cross pieces, and then attached that to a tree. So just knowing how the Romans were into efficiency, this makes the most sense to me. And this is from a Bible museum near Atlanta, Georgia, if any of you are down that way. It's Lafayette, Georgia, actually. There's an archaeologist has put this together. It's an archaeologist who worked in the land of Israel for 30, 40 years, something like that. And this is his illustration of how Jesus was probably crucified on a tree trunk with a cross piece and a smaller piece here, either to support the buttocks or the feet, and with the sign on top of it. It's a very interesting museum if you ever have the opportunity to go there. Another reason I say I think this being most likely, let's look at a few verses to consider. Acts 5, verse 30, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you murdered by hanging on a tree. I should mention again, the word that is translated tree here in all of these cases is Zulon, X-U-L-O-N, X-U-L-O-N. Zulon, which means a tree, but can refer to any type of wood, any wooden object made out of wood, like a stake, like a beam. So it isn't totally conclusive. But again, had it been that important, God could have easily told us, but he doesn't. But I do want us to consider these verses. Acts 10:39, we are witnesses of all things which he did, both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem, whom they killed by hanging on a tree. Acts 13:29. Now when they had fulfilled all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. Galatians 3, verse 13, Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, the death penalty, having become a curse for us, as it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. 1 Peter 2:24, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. So again, something for your consideration. Again, this is Zulon in all of these uses here. Can mean a tree, can mean any large piece of wood. So how did the T-shaped cross come to be the major symbol of Christianity? Again, you'll find this quote here in the booklet, but I want to mention this to you. The shape of, this is again from Vine's Expository Dictionary, the shape of the two-beamed cross had its origin in ancient Chaldea, another name for Babylon, and was used as the symbol of the god Tammuz, being in the shape of the mystic Ptah, the letter T, here, the initial of his name, in that country and in adjacent lands, including Egypt. By the middle of the 3rd century AD, the churches had either departed from or had travestied certain doctrines of the Christian faith in order to increase the prestige of the apostate ecclesiastical system. Pagans were received into the churches and were permitted largely to retain their pagan signs and symbols, hence the Ptah, or the letter T-shaped cross, in its most frequent form, with the cross piece lowered to a small letter T, was adopted to stand for the cross of Christ. So basically, to summarize what he's saying here is the T was a symbol for Tammuz in ancient Babylon, and there's the ancient Trinity from Babylon. It's not coming to me off the top of my head. Tammuz, Semiramis, and Nimrod. So yeah, it traces back that far. Some of you may also be familiar with the Ankh symbol from Egypt, which is like a T with a little loop over the top of it. that also was incorporated into Christianity and became part of the popularity of the sign of the cross. So because of its pagan origins, we do not wear it. We do not show it in our magazines, the publications, websites, that sort of thing, because its pagan origins far predate Christianity there. And many people do make a kind of a religious idol out of it, so we do avoid it. I want to give you another quote here from the Roman historian Seneca. This is Seneca the Younger is the one that quoted from earlier. He describes the horror of crucifixion and argues that it would be better to commit suicide than to endure crucifixion. And he wrote, "Can anyone be found who would prefer wasting away in pain, dying limb by limb, or letting out his life drop by drop, rather than expiring once for all?" In other words, die, get it over with, rather than this prolonged death of agony. "Can any man be found willing to be fastened to the accursed tree," referring to crucifixion again, "long sickly, already deformed from scourging and beating, swelling with ugly wheals on shoulders and chest, and drawing the breath of life amid long drawn out agony? He would have many excuses for dying even before mounting the cross." Basically just says this is a horrible way to die. Somebody would be better off dying any other way, committing suicide, rather than go through crucifixion. I might mention also the word excruciating, a word that means terrible agony in English, horrible, unbearable pain. Where does that word come from? Ex, you know, means from. Cruci or cruciate means from the cross in Latin. So crucifixion was so horrible, they literally had to invent a word, excruciating, to describe how intense and agonizing the pain of crucifixion was. How did Jesus, or a victim of crucifixion, die? Here's an illustration based on the best available evidence we have at this point. As we discussed yesterday and showed yesterday, victims were many times scourged before they were crucified. So they would experience a lot of blood loss, shock to the body. They could live up to several days in crucifixion before weakening and eventually dying. Often they died by suffocation, asphyxiation. Why? It had to do with the mechanics of a crucifixion. When somebody is crucified like that, the default of the body hanging down from the weight of the arms is that would put the chest in the exhale position after you've exhaled all your breath. To inhale a breath in this position, what you would have to do is lift yourself up on your feet to get a breath. What's going on with your feet? Your feet are nailed into the post. Literally nailed into the post. Here's an illustration of this. About 30, 40 years ago, they found the bones of a man who had been crucified in Jerusalem, crucified around the year 20, 25 AD, something like that, found his bones collected in a small coffin-like box, and they forensically examined those bones. We know the man was crucified because this is his heel bone. This is the literal heel bone, the biggest bone of your heel, and it had an iron nail driven through it. And notice the nail is bent. What happened is it was driven into the wood, it hit a knot in the wood, and bent back on itself. And it also had a little fragment of wood, kind of like a wood scrap, yay big or so, nailed to the outside, on the outside of the heel, as is illustrated here. So here is an illustration of how this man was crucified. Here's his foot bones, his heel, the nail was driven through and into the post with a little piece of wood to help keep it in place there. So we know this is how this particular individual was crucified. Also, the bones, it says, as we covered the prophecy from Zechariah, they've pierced my hands and my feet. We talked about that a little bit. I didn't go into detail. Hands, the word at that time, would have included the wrist area as well. That was considered part of the hand. They did not, as the traditional pictures show, nail through the hands. Why not? Well, take a 200-pound body and nails being driven through the hands, the tissue of the hands isn't strong enough to support the weight of the body. So it would just rip through the hands. So what they did is they drove the nails between the wrist bones right here. What goes through the wrist bones right there? All the nerves to the hand. You know how sensitive your hands are. It's why we have such a great sense of touch, because all those very precise, huge number of nerves in there. This nail is driven through those nerves. If you have ever had a nerve that has been cut or injured, you know what that feels like. Imagine having an iron spike about this long and about that big around as your thumbnail, driven through your wrist, through those nerves. It's going to be incredibly, incredibly painful. And this, we know from archaeological forensic evidence, is how victims were crucified. It's not to say that happened every time. There are indications in some cases they were just tied, their hands tied to the beams or the stake, as opposed to nailed. But we know in Jesus' case it was very clear that he was nailed, because he showed Doubting Thomas his hands and his feet and the wound in his side. So we do know that's what happened with him. So suffocating, yeah, getting back to that. Yeah, they would suffocate because the only way they could inhale is to stand up and put that pressure on the nails driven through their feet. And you can only do that so many times before the pain gets to you, you pass out, you go into shock, whatever, and then you suffocate because you can no longer inhale and get air into your system, so you suffocate to death. This could take anywhere from a few hours, could take several days, maybe as long as a week to do it. So again, the Romans designed this to be horrible, a horrible way to die. Again, to make an example of people. So this is how Jesus died. Or this was the process he was going through until he was stabbed in the side. It read briefly that yesterday they went around and they broke the legs of the men on either side of Jesus, but he was already dead. Let's look at that a little more in detail, because a common belief in traditional Christianity is that Jesus died of a broken heart. Not so. We'll see how he died. Zechariah 12, verse 10, "They will look on me, the one they have pierced." This is a prophecy of Christ's crucifixion. And it's referring to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. "They will look on me, the one whom they have pierced." Jesus himself said what about the Passover wine? That it represents my blood, which is poured out, not oozing out, not dripping out from the scourging, but poured out, indicating a major wound, for many for the forgiveness of sins. Time and time again, the scriptures speak of Jesus Christ, the importance of his shed blood. You might write down Acts 20, 28. I didn't include this up here, but Acts 20, 28, Ephesians 2, 13, Hebrews 9, 11 through 14, Hebrews 9, 11 through 14, and 1 Peter 1, 18 and 19. So clearly a central focus of Christ's sacrifice was his blood, which he shed, as we've talked about, for the sins of all mankind for all time. Regrettably, this is a little bit obscured the way it appears in our Bibles today. John, let's pick it up now, John 19, verses 30 through 34, at the bottom of page 128, if you want to follow along in the harmony. And this makes it appear that Jesus died first and then was stabbed by the Roman soldiers, but that's not quite the way it happened. So, bottom of page 128. And so when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is beginning the next day after Passover, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. But there's a problem with this specific order of events, because dead bodies, once the heart has stopped in death, they don't bleed a lot, because the circulatory system is a pressurized system. Your heart pumps to keep the blood circulating through the body. Once the heart starts pumping, what happens? The blood stops circulating and starts coagulating within the circulatory system, so you no longer bleed. I mean, a little bit of blood will come out of a dead body, but it's not being pumped out because the heart is no longer pumping. It's no longer pressurized. The problem is resolved when we look at older manuscripts of Matthew's gospel. Let's look across the page there to Matthew 27 and verse 49. And this older manuscripts contain some words that did appear in earlier manuscripts but are left out of most modern translations. And these missing words tell us the proper sequence of what's going on there. So from the 20th century New Testament, it includes these words: "However, another man took a lance, a spear, and pierced his side, and water and blood flowed from it. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." So these words show that Jesus is stabbed in the side with the spear of a Roman soldier, and he cried out, and then he died. And these words are included in several other translations, the Moffat translation, the Rotherham Emphasized Bible, and a number of other Bible versions include this in a footnote there, or a marginal reference, noting the words that are omitted there. So, do Matthew and John conflict with each other? No, they don't. It's just a different perspective. They're describing the same events from a different perspective. Matthew jumps immediately from Jesus' death to a description of the temple veil being ripped in half at his death, while John focuses on the fact that while the bones of the two men on either side of him, their legs' bones were broken, speeding up the suffocation process, incidentally, because they can no longer lift themselves up, so they'll be dead in a few minutes, that I didn't mention earlier. But John's emphasis is on the fact that, in contrast to those two men, not a bone of Jesus' body was broken, because he had to, again, be the Passover that did not have a single bone broken. So then John explains parenthetically how Jesus was already dead when they came around to break the legs of the other men. And his side had been pierced already with a spear. So John then goes on in verse 36 to tell us that this was the fulfillment of Psalm 34:20 and the symbolism of the Passover lambs, which were to be slain without a bone being broken. Let's see. Oh yeah, forgot to read the rest of this. John 19:32. "Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. but one of the soldiers pierced, or had pierced, as it can be translated, pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. He pierces it, and because the heart is still pumping, blood and water, the internal fluids of the body, come out of this gaping wound in his side. But again, dead bodies, once the heart has stopped pumping, they do not bleed. Let's see, so here's the missing verse from 20th century New Testament, which is in your harmony there. Let's talk about, I want to cover a couple of other loose ends in the time that we have here. One concerns a supposed, it's something that a lot of people do not understand and use it as supposed proof that Jesus went to, that one of the men who was crucified with Jesus went to heaven with him when he died, supposed proof of heaven. Luke 23, verses 42 and 43 says, "Then he, one of the condemned criminals, said to Jesus, 'Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom.' And Jesus said to him, 'Assuredly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise.'" So many people take this as indicating the condemned man went to Jesus, went to heaven with Jesus at death. Is this the case? Well, again, commas, punctuation, like the commas after "assuredly I say to you," there was no punctuation in Greek at that period. It just didn't exist. No question marks, no periods, no commas. So you can take the commas out of there, and what Jesus is saying, "Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." Not that he's going to be with Jesus that day in paradise, but that he's assuring him, emphasizing to him, "Right now, I'm telling you, you will be with me in paradise." Now, does that mean he's going to be in the first resurrection? No, but as far as this condemned man knows, what world is he going to be resurrected into? He's going to be resurrected into a paradise. It's just not a paradise in heaven. We know this can't be what Jesus meant, because what did Jesus himself say after he is resurrected 3 days and three nights later? John 20, verse 17. This is when Mary comes to him there in the garden after he's been resurrected, and Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me," or "do not touch me," as some versions put it, "for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father and to my God and your God." So 3 days and three nights later, Jesus is resurrected, and he has not yet ascended to heaven to be with his Father. So how could he tell the condemned man that he's going to heaven with him that day when Jesus, 3 days, three nights later, says he hasn't yet ascended? So that one's really easy to knock down and demonstrate the fallacy of that. He clearly did not go to paradise that day. He went to the tomb, and that's where he was for 3 days and three nights. I won't cover the 3 days and three nights. I did give you a handout last week on that, so you can take that home, study that, keep it there in your harmony, which goes through and shows the timing, how all of that fits together, and that is reflected in the way this harmony is structured and organized. Let's see, I do want to draw your attention to a few other things. Just trying to gauge my time here. Let's see, let's pick up the story. We left off yesterday with the crucifixion. So Jesus' body is laid in the tomb shortly before sundown. They're in a hurry to get it in the tomb before the Sabbath begins, the Sabbath being the high day, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So let's pick up the story in John 20 and verse 1 at the bottom of page 131. And I'll just read from the harmony. I'll read from John's account because he is a direct participant here. So John 20, verse 1, bottom of page 131. "Now on the first day of the week," so this is Sunday morning. First day began at sunset, Saturday evening, the night before. So Mary Magdala, Mary of Magdala, went to the tomb early while it was still dark. Notice this. It is still dark. The sun has not risen. So the whole idea of Jesus rising on a Sunday morning at sunrise is a fallacy because it's dark when Mary goes to the tomb, and what does she find? She finds that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Verse 2. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, that's referring to John, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Peter therefore went out and the other disciple, John, and were going to the tomb. So they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloths lying there. Yet he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen cloths lying there, and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen clothes, but folded together in a place by itself. How many of you are familiar with the Shroud of Turin? Know about that? Okay, just a handful of you. It's a famous relic that is supposedly the burial shroud of Jesus Christ, and it has a full-length body on it with an image there that is supposedly that of Jesus with long hair and all of that. This verse right here alone proves that that cannot be accurate because it shows very clearly there was a separate cloth for Jesus' head that was set aside separately. The Shroud of Turin is all one long piece there, not two separate pieces. Yes, Charles?
They have like a face towel, and then during the, I don't know if it's on the History Channel documentary on the Shroud of Turin, but they actually, the blood stain, they matched it up with the Shroud of Turin, and they matched the face sheet.
Okay.
And they were saying that this went with that, and then they put the Shroud of Turin.
Okay.
So they claim to have a boat.
I am familiar with that. I don't recall what it's called, so I didn't include it in my notes. But I've also read several accounts that is provably dated to a much later period, so didn't bother to discuss that. So Shroud of Turin is a famous relic. They display it about once every 10 years, and the public can come in and pay $100 to go see it, things like this. It's become a big money maker, but you can look it up if you're interested in that. But yeah, what Charles is saying is true. There's another piece that they say was this other one, but it does disprove the Shroud of Turin here. Verse 8 of John 20, then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also, and he saw and believed. Again, this is John. For as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. Then the disciples went away again to their own homes. But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. What this is describing is tombs of the first century commonly had a shelf. I say a shelf, you might think of a bed carved into the stone, so the bodies would lay there until they decayed, and so an angel is at either end of this stone bench that is there. And then the angels said to Mary, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, and did not know that it was Jesus. Why? Well, it's not entirely daylight yet. It's still dusky or early morning light there. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she turned and said to him, "Rabboni," which is to say, teacher. So she now recognizes him. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father," verse we just read, "but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God." And Mary came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. Bottom of this page, let's look at something else here now from Mark's account. Mark 16 and verse 11 near the bottom of the page. Mark adds the detail that the disciples did not believe her when she came and told them this. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they did not believe. They did not believe. And this is another evidence of the authenticity of the Gospels on two different levels. One, if you're living any time in the first few centuries after Jesus Christ, say first century through the third or fourth century, and you're making up this story, there's no way you would make up the story of women going to the tomb and seeing Jesus resurrected, because women were looked down on. Their testimony often was not considered valid in a court of law. So you would never fabricate a story with women being the eyewitnesses to a risen Jesus Christ. You just wouldn't do it, because you'd have witness. It would be like making up a story today, but your main witness is a junkie, drug-addled, homeless person sleeping in the gutter. Would his testimony be reliable? No. And in the same way, not to compare women to to drug-riddled junkies. Don't get me wrong there, but it's just a matter of credibility. If you're making up a story, you would never make up a story with women as the primary witnesses of this event. It just wouldn't happen. So this shows that, yes, this is true. Nobody would make up a story like this. It just would not make sense. And the second point is, if you are making up the story and you've got your heroes, who are the heroes? The heroes are the apostles. Would you make up a story in which they all run away from Jesus into the night and abandon him? And would you make up a story in which they then do not even believe that he was resurrected? No, you wouldn't. Somebody who's fabricating a story would just never say these things, because they're embarrassing, frankly. It's embarrassing that the heroes of your story, the apostles, ran away and abandoned their master. It's embarrassing that they did not believe. Now, if you're going to make up a story, you're going to make them the heroes. Yeah, they were great, they were mighty, they were strong, they were great spiritual giants and all that. No, not that they were a bunch of scared rabbits who ran away and didn't believe the woman who came and told them that Jesus had been resurrected. So these are just some of the little things that indicate, yes, these Gospels are accurate accounts. Yes, they are true. Next page, page 134. Let's notice another detail here at the top of the page from Matthew's account, Matthew 28, verses 11 through 15. Now, while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all the things that had happened. When they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying, "Tell them his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will appease him and make you secure." So they took the money and did as they were instructed. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. So here again is another mark of authenticity to the Gospels, because who makes up a story that the body had been stolen unless the body is really gone? They have to have a way to account for the fact that nobody can find the body. There was a guy who was dead, who was crucified, a bloody mess, laid in a tomb. The tomb is sealed. There are guards placed outside the tomb. And yet, several days later, the body isn't there, and they can't find the body. And they found the body, that would put the lie to the whole resurrection story. No, he wasn't resurrected, because here's his body, here's his rotting, bloody corpse. But they can't find a body, so they have to account for that. So what do? They go to the guards, and they bribe them to lie and say his disciples came and stole the body. Incidentally, there's a very interesting movie you might want to watch sometime. Came out 3 or 4 years ago called Risen. And it's has some good parts, some bad parts, as nearly any religious movie does. But it's a fictionalized story of a Roman centurion who comes to Jerusalem right at the time Jesus is being crucified. And the events we've described take place, and he is tasked with finding the body and disproving the story. And he goes around. He finally tracks down some of the apostles, takes him a long, circuitous route to find him. He finds the guards, and he interviews them. And it's an interesting story. I won't give it away, but it's an interesting take on this story that has some good thoughts in it, some good things to think about. I won't ruin the story. But again, this is another mark of authenticity, because they have to account for the body. So the best they can come up with is that the disciples stole the body out from under the eyes of soldiers who were stationed right there outside the tomb. And again, I should mention, if you were a soldier and you were that derelict in your duty, the common punishment is death, too. So that's why they have to bribe them to come up with this story. Let's go across the page to John 20 and let's skip over that. And let's skip now to Matthew 28 and verses 16 through 20. This is on page 137. Won't go through all the other details here. They're very straightforward. You don't need a lot of explanation about them. But page 137, I do want to bring up something here. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted, still not 100% convinced. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Amen." A couple of things I want to point out. This is very familiar. It's from this that we get our motto of the United Church of God, preaching the gospel and preparing a people. There are two elements here. You proclaim the gospel and you make disciples. Incidentally, a matter of Greek grammar where it says, "Go, therefore, and make disciples." Disciples there is not a noun, but a verb. What it literally says in Greek is go and disciple the nations. Disciple the nations. We've talked a lot in this class over the course of this academic year about what it means to be a disciple, the master and the rabbi relationship. A disciple wants to become just like his master in every way. And what Jesus is telling his disciples here is, do the same thing to others that I have done to you. You go. I have shown you what I am like. You have lived with me 3.5 years. You followed me. You've seen. You've heard my teaching. You've seen how I do everything. Now take that and go and teach that to others. That's what is conveyed in this here. Go and make disciples of them. Now you are the teachers. I'm leaving you, but now you are the teachers, and you make disciples. Teach them the things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So this is our marching orders as a church, to preach the gospel, to prepare a people, to make disciples. What I've tried to do in this class this year is, is to turn you to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. That's so incredibly crucial. That is where a lot of your faith is going to be grounded on. When you face trials, when you face challenges and difficulties in life ahead, if you, I could recount some of my history in the church and trials and battles I've fought. Don't want to discourage you. But what has saved me through the trials that I've been through is having a relationship with God the Father and with Jesus Christ. And you'll see people in leadership positions who will do things. We had a horrible split in the church several years ago in which people in different positions of leadership did very horrible things, very unchristian things. And that kind of thing can destroy people's faith. But your faith has to be in God the Father and in Jesus Christ. I'm just speaking from the heart here. I hadn't planned to really say this, but that's what's going to save you spiritually. That's what is going to bring you through. If you put your faith in other human beings, you are going to be disappointed, no matter who that person is. That's why your faith has to be in God the Father and Jesus Christ. That's where your relationship has to be. Okay, I could go on and read through the Gospels, but actually this is a very good stopping place, not many better stopping places, and with the commission to the church. I did want to note one more thing in John's Gospel. I love the way John ends his Gospel, page 138, the end of the story here, John 21, verse 25. And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which, if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that could be written. And I love that. What he's saying here is, there's so many things that I just don't have room for, but you could write enough books to fill the entire world overflowing, and even that wouldn't convey everything that Jesus did. And that's a good conclusion to the story of the Gospels. I did want to draw your attention to something else in the booklet. I could take the time to read through this, but I would probably be interrupted in the middle of it, so I'll dispense with it. But pages 46 and 47, I do encourage you to read that. The title of this sidebar is, Do Other Non-Biblical Sources Confirm Jesus Christ's Existence? And what we see here is testimony from three different Roman historians that are listed here, Cornelius Tacitus, Caius Suetonius Tranquillus, and Pliny the Younger. And just from what they write, and these are men who were no friends of Christianity by any means. In some cases, they're actively opposed to Christianity and persecuting Christians. But as you can see from the bottom of page 46 there, just from what they say, we know that there was a group of people called Christians, and they derived their name from Christus, a Latinized form of Christ, meaning Messiah. We learn that this Christus was executed during the reign of Tiberius, who was the emperor, and at the hands of Pontius Pilate. And we know the very narrow window of dates in which both of them were ruling. And that this new movement involved a most mischievous superstition, as one of them describes it. What was a most mischievous superstition? Well, the writer doesn't say. But it would not surprise me, just reading it on the surface, it appears to me the belief that a man rose from the dead. And that, in Roman thinking, would surely be a most mischievous superstition that had rallied these people and energized them. What did rally these people? The fact that their Messiah had been crucified and was raised from the dead. This new movement began in Judea and spread to Rome, and that early Christians considered Christ to be a divine being. We know all of these facts from the Gospels and the Book of Acts, but here, these are facts recorded by Roman historians who weren't believers at all. So again, when you have people tell you, well, I don't believe the Bible, I don't believe the Gospels, I don't believe Jesus was real, well, hey, give them a copy of this. Tell them to read this. Educate yourself. Get the facts. There's also a fairly lengthy section here about the testimony from Josephus. Josephus mentions John the Baptizer. He mentions James, the half-brother of Jesus. There's a fairly lengthy section in there about Jesus Christ that was apparently added to over the centuries by Christian copyists who were copying Josephus, and they added some details that Josephus did not originally write. And let's see, I think I have a quick interjection. I wanted to show you this that I came across. This is a piece of graffiti that was etched in stone in the city of Rome. And this is another indicator of why I believe Jesus was crucified this way. This is impossible to date, but it comes from somewhere 200 to 300 A.D., and it has a crucified donkey. You can see the cross and a man with the head of a donkey and a figure standing looking up at this crucified donkey. And this inscription says, I don't remember the man's name exactly, but it was something like, Alexander worships his God. This may be the earliest actual drawing of crucifixion. It is, to our knowledge, the earliest drawing of crucifixion that we know of. And it's making a mockery of Christianity. That here's a guy who's so stupid, he worships a donkey that was crucified. An obvious insult to Jesus Christ. But this would have been the way a lot of Romans viewed the crucifixion. Nobody worships a God who was crucified, because you only did that to the worst of criminals. So just an interesting sideline. I've actually seen that at a museum in Rome. But let's read what Josephus wrote about Jesus. And I mentioned, and again, this is all spelled out here in the sidebar in the booklet, Christian copyists apparently added a lot of things that were not in Josephus' original account. But back, I think it was in the 1970s, an Arabic version of Josephus was found that is apparently older than the versions of Josephus that we have today, which were translated from the Greek. And this is the way it says it. So apparently this is originally what Josephus wrote, or very close to what Josephus originally wrote. And again, Josephus comes along. He's writing in the 80s and 90s AD. He never met Jesus, but he's a very good historian. And what does he say about Jesus? He says, at this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. Exactly what we read in the Gospels. And many people from among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Exactly what we read in the Gospels and the book of Acts and the New Testament, for that matter. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. Exactly what we see in the Gospels. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon their loyalty to him. Exactly what we see in the Gospels. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion. Exactly what we see in the Gospels. And that he was alive. Exactly what we see in the Gospels. Accordingly, they believed that he was the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. Exactly what we see in the Gospels and the book of Acts. So we see testimony from at least three Roman historians, writing within, I'd have to double check the dates here. Let's see, 120, 140, and my eye is not falling on the third date. But here are people writing within a century after these events. They're writing as credible historians, and they verify the basic facts of the Gospels, of the book of Acts, of the New Testament here. Again, you'll read, some of you will be going back to college, you'll hear the Bible ridiculed at times, you'll hear a lot of nonsense, a lot of fake news about the Bible, but this is what the historians said. And again, they weren't friends of Christianity. None of them converted to Christianity. They're hostile to Christianity for the most part. Josephus seems to be neutral about it. But the facts are there. The facts are there that Jesus was real, that what we see recorded in the Gospels and the book of Acts is real history. So, any questions from any of you as we wrap up here? Kayla and Kerr, yes.
So I read at the end of Mark that some manuscripts don't have the end of Mark, and I always found that very strange. Do you have any comments about that?
I'm glad you brought that up. I was just looking into that 2 weeks ago. Yeah, this is another thing many of you will come across. The let's see, I think it's Mark 16 verses
9 through 20.
And also the section about John, from John, where the woman caught in adultery is brought to Jesus. And I covered that in the remez. Jesus stoops and writes in the dust. You'll find a lot, and I looked into both of these just about 2 weeks ago, and there's a lot of fake news out there in Bible scholarship, and this is a case of that. If you're interested in Bible texts and documents and so on, let me know. I can send you a couple of resources on that. There's some good ones in the ABC library there. But regarding those two passages specifically, you will see, and many of you probably have it in your Bibles, a footnote saying some manuscripts do not include this, implying that it should not be there, that it was added on a century or two later. But what they don't tell you is that the number of manuscripts that do not contain those last, the ending of Mark or that portion about the woman caught in adultery, there's like 2 to 6 ancient manuscripts that do not include those portions. Of those 2 to 6, some of them includes some of the verses from Mark specifically. But there's over 1,000 ancient manuscripts that do contain those. So the footnotes, I've never seen a footnote that spells out exactly how many manuscripts do not include it, but the actual numbers are 2 to 6 that do not include it, and well over 1,000 that do. So who are you going to believe? And there are also very early, what are called the church fathers, the other people who wrote from, say, 200 AD to 500 AD, and many, many of them quote those verses in there. Matthew 28:19 is another one we just read about baptizing in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. That's another one some people think was added later. No, because it's quoted as early as about 120, 130, 140 by other writers quoting from Matthew. So even though we don't have the original copies of the Gospels written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we do have copies and copies of copies, and we do have people who are quoting. You can almost reconstruct the entirety of the Gospels just by quotes from early Christian writings, say up to about the year 400, 450 or so. We have nearly all of the Gospels existing just in quotes from other people who are recording that. So that's a whole issue of study, but a great question, Kayla. That's a very good one to bring up and bring to your attention here. Because again, you'll see a lot of fake news, fake articles, fake scholarship about that, where people misrepresent the actual facts to try to convince you the Gospels, as I mentioned early on, the Gospels were written many centuries later by people who didn't witness these events. But the facts just does not stand up to scrutiny, and they can fool a lot of people who don't know the facts by their arguments. But the real facts are very, make it very obvious. So, Kerr, you had a question too? Yeah.
The prophecy you said that his bones will not be, there will be no bones that will be broken. How right. would he be pierced without any of his bones being? How would he be nailed? His bones being broken.
Good question. He is elevated somewhat as he's crucified. We know he's elevated some because they put the sponge on the hyssop stalk to give him the sour wine, which is done, I didn't cover this, but that's done as a painkiller. So they hold it up to his mouth. So he's somewhat elevated. So he's being stabbed from below, not side to side. So obviously the spear would have gone up under the rib cage and into the internal organs and so on. And therefore blood and water came out, whether the water was from the bladder or the intestines or lungs or whatever, we don't know. His lungs may well have been filling with fluid then as he's suffocating to death. So it didn't need to go through the rib cage to stab him there and therefore break any of the rib bones.
Being nailed on the hands and on
Being nailed? Feet, yeah. Well, if it's between the wrist bones, it's not going to go through the bones themselves, because you have two long bones there, so it goes between them. I should mention this too, in the crucified man, they know that because they could see the grooves in the bones where the nail made grooves in the bones as it was driven through the man's wrist. So that's why they know he was crucified there as opposed to through the palms of the hands, as is traditionally explained. As far as nailing in the heel or the foot, I've thought about that, and obviously that man's heel bone was still intact. It had a nail driven through it, but the bone is still intact, so it did not break that bone of that crucified man. That incidentally is another indication why the traditional view of crucifixion is not accurate, because it's commonly depicted with Jesus' feet overlapping and a single nail being driven through both of them. Just try to imagine the logistics of, you got two very odd shaped objects in the form of feet, and you're trying to drive a nail through both of them and into a piece of wood. Just logistically, even if you got other soldiers holding his feet in place, it's going to be very, very difficult. So it would be much easier, as we saw from the illustration, put his feet on either side of the upright post and nail through the feet from the side, not through the top. So just a matter of practicality and efficiency. Again, the Romans did things in an efficient way. Good question. Any other questions from anybody? Okay, great questions. I just want to express my appreciation for being here to teach all of you this year. Appreciate your attention. Hope you go out of this class having learned a lot. Dig beneath the surface. That's what I've tried to help you do a lot in this year, is to dig beneath the surface. Dig deeper. You get part of the story there on the surface, but when you start digging beneath, when you start understanding the culture, you learn a lot more. You find there's a lot more depth, a lot more detail, a lot more lessons for us to dig out from that. Again, if you want a really good resource here, I recommended first day, I think, the Cultural Background Study Bible. I brought it in my first class. I haven't brought it out in later trips. There is a copy of it in the library. There you can look for Cultural Background Study Bible, written by, well, the Bible is the same, but the notes to it are written by a couple of very good scholars. And it's available in a new international version, and recently, as of several months ago, a new King James version as well. And it's there's hardbacks, there's leather bound. I'm personally waiting for the large print version because my eyes are getting worse on me, but I'll buy a new King James version of it when it comes out in the large print edition, because some of the footnotes are quite small and a bit hard to read there. So that's a really good resource. I have a number of people asking me about resources, and that's the number one that I recommend. There's also another one you'll find in the same section as you go in the door of the library. It's near the bottom level, just about straight across from the door. There's another one there called the First Century Study Bible, and it has kind of an aqua color cover, kind of like Andrew's shirt there, about that color, something like that, and the green water bottle up here. Fairly easy to spot on the shelf. And the the cultural background study Bibles in a tan colored box, very, very close to that. They're very close. So those are some good resources for you. So if think of any other questions any time later, future years, feel free to send me an email. But been great being with you here. So wish you all the best, and we'll see you somewhere down the road, hopefully.